I'm Katie Monson, and I live in Santa Cruz, California, where I teach in environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, which is a beautiful school and a great place to teach in environmental studies. We have, especially when one of my biggest areas that I work with is food systems. We have a big farm that's it's 50 years old, our teaching and research farm. And we have smaller gardens, food-producing gardens around campus, nestled in the redwoods. So it's a pretty amazing place to get to work on this kind of stuff. And I teach classes in sustainability and freshwater ecology and all kinds of things. I said yes to a lot of things, and now I have a really lovely plate of things I get to do up there. And so one of those things is really this, thinking about sustainability and in particular food systems. And I teach a whole class on climate and agriculture in winter right now. And so this is just a little bit of that class condensed into a little block of time. And so if you want, you know, come on down next January to March, and you can take the whole 10 weeks if you get intrigued with my environmental studies students. It's good fun. So a couple things I wanted to do was really to look at the connections between agriculture and climate change and how they affect one another, because they're deeply interrelated. And then to think about a little bit too about some of the ways that we can reform our food system. And because otherwise, I don't know what I would do with my time if I didn't have some hope that we would be able to work with what we've got going on. Otherwise, yeah, it'd be really hard to talk to a room full of students all the time if I didn't think that we had some avenues that we really needed to be on and to encourage them to follow some of those paths. All right, so that's just a little bit about me. And what I want to do is start off with talking about food in general a little bit. And so I want you to think of one or two foods that are most important to you. What's some food that's really important to you? So I'm going to give you about 30 seconds for you to just think about it, and then I'll have you tell somebody else, the people at your table or in smaller groups around your table, what food is really important to you and why that is. Okay, so I'm going to give you about 30 seconds now. I think I might prop a door open just to have airflow. Is that all right?
Yes.
What you're thinking?
Eggs.
Every day I eat eggs.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
Every morning for breakfast.
I was thinking potatoes.
Meat really had something to a meal.
I buy them in bulk from Costco.
So bacon doesn't seem to be a problem.
Nuts. Yeah, any kind of nuts in particular?
No, they're all pretty good.
They are really good.
Cashews.
This is a nutty family.
Eggs.
Eggs.
Yeah, Robert.
Oats.
Yeah, oats. And why do you love oats?
Heart health, I figure, helps with heart.
Yeah, your dad ate them for years and years and years and years.
Fresh fruits and vegetables.
Fresh fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
Soybeans.
Oh, and soybeans.
Soybeans, yeah. Any, that's the basic source of it.
Yeah.
I found that if I can end up getting some leg cramps, but not if I have bananas regularly.
Yeah, the potassium.
So bananas, even though they don't grow them right around here.
Not so much. Not so much right here. Great. And so one of the reasons I like to start with this, and I do this even in my big class in the, or my not so big, it's not huge, but my class, my regular term class, is that food is, especially when we, in that class, especially when we start talking about meat, we really talk about the different reasons people eat meat, right? But there are all these different foods that we eat, and for a variety of reasons, right? There's health reasons that we eat. There's social reasons. I think I heard somebody say Syrian bread, which is like in our Monson extended family, that's a really important food to our family. Grandma Olga made it and in quantities. And it's culturally part of our, or familially part of our, part of us in that particular bread.
Which kind did you say?
Syrian. It's called Syrian bread, but do we know why it's called? It's pita bread. Pita bread. But she was from Lebanon. I mean, her family's from Lebanon, so I don't know. Do we know what we don't? Do we?
We always called it Syrian bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
Syria is not too far from Lebanon.
Right. So somehow it's translated. It was part of Syria. So there's like health reasons and cultural reasons, and I heard chocolate, right, and fresh fruits and vegetables, things that just taste good to us too. So there's all these different reasons we eat different kinds of food. So I just like to keep that in mind while we're talking about food issues, that it's not something like, maybe if we were just, if it was like, this is the reason we should go to a solar electric grid, right? Or a distributed energy grid with this going. There's a lot less, generally speaking, we have a lot less emotion around solar energy, distributed energy networks, right? Than around food, this thing that we are interacting with every day, over and over throughout the day, right? So just making sure that's out there and just respecting, thinking about how we respect food choices while at the same time trying to push forward how we make a more sustainable food system. So just holding that out there while we do this. All right, so one of the big goals is talking about how climate and agriculture are connected, right? So what we're gonna do is make mind maps in groups and then on the board ultimately, pulling it together. So the first thing I want you to do is just on your own, and there's this, I found this awesome daisy wheel printer paper downstairs. And so on a piece of paper, just start, I'll give you like 2 minutes just on your own. Try to think of like 10 words that would go with climate and agriculture. How are these connected, or what are the connections between climate and agriculture? How are they connected? So I see some people are starting on this. So what we do when we make a mind map is we're really just trying to, Elizabeth can correct me on map usage, but this is a tool that people use to just try to put a lot of things in relationship to one another. So if we put climate and agriculture, this is the way I'm doing it, but you can do it other ways. You could also put them in separate bubbles and connect them or whatever. What are some of the words that you're coming up with, and how do they fit around climate and agriculture? So you're going to add them out and around. And then some of them will have connections to each other.
Who said something about food?
Yeah. Got really quiet. I didn't mean to make it really quiet.
Food would be
so you can start working.
Agriculture.
You can start working then in groups and try to kind of pull together. What would a mind map start to look like around climate? All right, so we'll start putting up some of what we can, we're gathering from you, and I have lots of things that I know about this too, right? So then I'll make sure we get those topics too as we go along. So climate and agriculture. So what's one thing that came up for a group? Any group want to start?
Water.
Water is huge. And so, what about water?
Temperature.
Oh yeah, it's related to, yeah, it's related to, so I'm gonna put temperature as its own.
Sustainability of water, availability.
Yeah, yep, sustainability and availability.
Storage of water.
Mm-hmm. Cleanliness.
Irrigation.
Sustainability, yeah, so it's used for irrigation, yep. Sometimes, well, like, some places in our country are rain-fed still, right? So, like, Minnesota. It's really cool if when you, right, Minnesota, when you dry it, when you're flying over land and it looks like that, that tends to be rain-fed irrigation, because you can just plow up to your edges of your fields. And then when you see, except in vegetable production in California, it doesn't look like that. I mean, it looks like this, but it's totally irrigated. But when you see this across the Midwest, when it's moving to circles like that, then these are center pivot irrigation, right? Or across the central Washington or whatever. So it's cool to fly across our landscape and see the different kinds of farming based on different kinds of water availability. Okay, so, right, so availability, sustainability, so we said storage.
Geography of the terrain makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Growing seasons and duration of sunlight.
Yeah, and so just overall for climate and agriculture, so this is this, so it's like place is coming up this week. So the place, what will grow where? So a terrain, and there are lots of things we can say about this. And that's connected to water, it's connected to temperature, growing season. And this storage of water is really interesting because some of the changes they're predicting for some areas, so climate change is going to have different impacts in different places, it's going to look different in different places. One thing that might be happening in the western U.S. is that we have bigger pulses of water. So with warmer temperatures, there'll be less snow storage, and this happens in Washington, Oregon, and greatly in California, where there's a lot of water stored as snow, right? We store our water as snow, and then it melts slowly and goes down into rivers, and that feeds the agriculture along the way, right? But if it's warmer, then there will be less snow stored. We'll get more pulses of water. And did you hear? It was very exciting down in California this year where one of our, where Shasta, was that Shasta? Was that Shasta, right? No, yeah. Which one?
Lake Shasta.
Yeah, Lake Shasta. Orville, well, yeah. The Orville Dam at Lake Shasta was just about to fail, the spillway.
That's Orville.
Yeah, that's Orville. The Orville Dam.
Yeah.
I got to split them in my head. It's so crazy to see so much water down there again. But the Orville Dam, it had to use its emergency spillway, which actually turned out wasn't in very good condition, and they're trying to take the pressure off so the whole giant dam wasn't going to be compromised in any way. But
tallest,
so they were
tallest dam in the country.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't remember. But it's like we're having to go back and look at this infrastructure that's old now and how we deal with that. So if you have these bigger melts, there's going to be more water in pulses. And so how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that in a changing climate? And then just availability. In some places, there'll just be less water overall. And then, all this matches with that. How do we do that sustainably and depending on the geography? And terrain in place. And temperature, we're expecting temperatures overall to go up. And so what does temperature have an effect on?
Growing season.
Yeah, the growing season. So in some places, it's going to extend the growing season. A lot of places, it'll extend the growing season. So that means we'll actually need more water in some places. So already straining that system more.
And then it could also become too hot to grow the crops that have been originally there.
Yeah, and so there are a couple different ways that looks. So one example is chill hours. Have you heard chill hours before? Mm-hmm. So many deciduous fruit trees, like apples and plums and cherries and pears and peaches, all those kind of fruit trees. They have to have reach a particular number of hours of cold. Like they're a couple different competing, because scientists like to get excited about different things. And one of those things is which exact way to measure chill hours. But there are a couple different ways you can do it. But we'll just say that generally you're looking at how many hours below 45 degrees do you build up between fall and the end of, I think it's like the end of January or end of February. So you have this window and you start counting up how many hours you get below 45 degrees. And if you don't get enough hours below 45 degrees, different trees will have trouble flowering and setting fruit the following year. They need that cold temperature to essentially reset their systems, and it tells them, that length of time tells them that it's been cold enough, long enough, that spring will probably come, and it triggers bud break and everything. And if you don't get that amount of cold, then there in the spring you get fewer flowers, the flower timing is off, so the pollinators might miss each other, the trees might not get pollinated as well. You have these effects on the fruit the following year. And it varies by type of tree and by within that which particular varieties. So some varieties need fewer chill hours and some need more. And so you have to look and see. But if our temperature is warm overall, we're going to not be able to get those chill hours. Yeah.
So with the temperature rising, how does that affect the insects?
Yeah, that's another key problem with temperature. I'm going to make a whole pest category.
Well, and pollinators.
And yeah, pollinators too, right? And pollinators. And when I'm teaching this class in the school year, I say a lot that, wow, we don't actually know yet. We don't actually know yet. A lot of these things. We don't actually know what the overall impact on pollinators is going to be yet. That's not well figured out. There will probably be more diseases or pests that attack pollinators. And the pollinators themselves might be trying to move with changing floral resources. It's hard to tell yet. We don't totally know.
I only know, of course, that insecticides affect bees.
Right, right. That's true. Insecticides.
So how much more that's going to be a problem.
Right, and so here's a way that these are actually connected too. So pests are probably going to increase. The insects generally like the warmer temperatures. They tend to reproduce more when it's warmer. And overall, what we're going to be seeing is a northward migration of pests. I'm just assuming the board is oriented north up. So, but the pests, they're going to slowly be moving upward. There's concern about that as they're moving with warmer temperatures. Here in temperate regions, we have it pretty good because usually winter is cold enough that we knock back a lot of pests when it's cold and when it freezes. And so we kind of get to reset every year. But if it's warm, then they get to stay in those conditions. Their populations don't diminish as much. And then each year there's a movement northward of pests, but they'll be able to stay here all year.
Could climate affect farming practices, like soil practices and things like that?
Yeah, it could. And I'll make one last connection between these. So if this is if it's increasing pests, probably people are going to be using increasing pesticides, which then if we've seen effects of pesticides on pollinators, so they may be connected like that too. Okay, wait, so say it one more time.
Climate may
mm-hmm.
change soil practices or farming practices.
And this is one where they affect each other. I'll just put
methods.
Yeah, on-farm practices, on-farm tillage. That's kind of how I'll frame that. So tillage is anytime you're moving equipment across the soil to break up the soil. So it's like you're taking care of weeds is one of the primary goals of tillage. And so the way tillage is done, now you're going across to break up the weeds, and then you're going back to make a seed bed, and then you go back again to form a seed bed, then you go back through again to get more weeds. And so you're doing this several times in a season. And actually, organic agriculture, the way it is, tends to do more tillage than other agriculture, because the other agriculture is using conventional agriculture tends to rely on herbicides and pesticides to knock back weeds, right? Well, herbicides and insecticides. But so the tillage, every time you're moving a tractor through the soil, you're using fuel, and so you're releasing carbon dioxide. So that affects the climate. And then also when you do tillage, you're disrupting the soil ecosystem, and you're bringing oxygen down in for the microbes. And when the microbes have oxygen, they start burning through, they start eating soil organic matter faster. Their populations are excited and awake and alive with more oxygen down in the soil. And so they start releasing more carbon dioxide too. So one farmer told me, really you should look at it as every time a plow is going through a field, that you should be able to just see a carbon dioxide plume essentially behind it. Yeah.
A new method is strip till, there's a theory that when you're dragging that dirt around so much that you're actually disrupting the microbes and the topsoil climate, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that my family in Minnesota is starting to do some strip till where you're just, your tractor has just got a thing where it's just plugging your plants down into the refuse from the year before. So you're leaving, say, your plant refuse from the year before on the field, and then you're just literally plugging those. It's like hair plugs. You're just going right down into the dirt.
Yeah, so there are a couple different times. So if you're not tilling at all, there's no-till. There are different methods of no-till agriculture too. So one is spraying everything down with herbicides, spraying down the field to take care of weeds, spraying it with herbicides, and then planting directly into that. Another is, there's a farmer in Pennsylvania that's really into, he's creating all these tools like crimpers, like hair crimpers. Maybe you weren't doing your hair in the 80s, but they're these crimpy things that you would have heat applied to your hair and it'd make it all crimpy. So it's this big crimpy roller that's like this, and he's going over the field and crimping the weeds, or not the weeds, but, well, weeds in the previous crop to knock it down, but without really disrupting the soil. So he's still killing what was there and getting it ready, but without totally turning up the soil. And then there's strip tillage, where people are coming through and they'll just till a couple feet at a time. So the only place that's disturbed is right there. And then that's where you can plant plants into. Yeah, so there's a lot of work people are doing in this area to try to figure out how these could work and what that would look like. In some places, straight the no-till that's really herbicide based that's led to an increase in herbicide use. So we have to balance. I don't know. It's really hard to figure this all out. We have to figure it out like right now, right? But it's really hard to figure out what all the balance of that is and which one is going to be best, because they're building organic matter, but they are increasing herbicide use.
Are we skipping animals?
No, we can totally put animals in there too. Get rid of the tillage. Yeah, and so these are affecting each other, the climate and the agriculture affecting each other based on the type of tillage we do. And so animals definitely are connected with climate and agriculture. And in what ways?
Water.
Water, yep. They have a high water demand, right?
Take up a lot of land space.
Land space, yep.
CO2, ammonia.
Oh, that's up connected up here, yep.
Methane.
Methane.
Methane
sure.
production.
There's ammonia.
And there, and also ammonia.
Yeah,
put it that way. Yeah, ammonia.
Maybe a new viruses and diseases coming.
Hmm. Yep, definitely. The pests, as it's warmer, the pests will be able to, the animals will be experiencing greater pest pressure as well as the agricultural system.
Drugs
from those, yeah. Though I imagine there's climate connection, but that's the drugs are but if you think of how climate connected, there are other effects, yeah.
Well, as the temperature goes up too, the animals are used to regulating temperature at a certain level, so if it gets warmer, they're gonna be under more stress.
Yep. Heat stress for the animals. Go ahead.
You have politics.
Oh yeah,
policies, subsidies, whatever.
Definitely, there's a really strong human component to all of this, right?
And with that economy and how it drives.
Definitely.
And whether it's supportive of agriculture or not.
Yeah, so. And what kind of agriculture?
Exactly.
And right, and who? In the whole USDA research budget, there's 2% for agriculture, or for organic agriculture. Sorry, it's just this little bit.
Transportation costs?
Oh yeah, transportation. Right, so there's this other
place?
Yeah, well, oh yeah, it's connected. It's totally connected to place. So there's the food
and the economy.
Yeah.
Challenging.
I know, it starts to look like this.
Well, it's not, you know, it's also just transporting produce, right? So you've got, and there's strides being made forward in terms of, this is after California, but people starting to figure out they can greenhouse grow a lot of the produce that they would ordinarily get from open fields in California.
Right.
Closer at home.
Right, and so, let's see, where do we put, so some local, looking back at local agriculture, right? Especially fruits and vegetables.
That might be like how trends affect.
Yeah.
I'm the only one that stayed to watch the end of that movie last night.
Oh!
Demain, and they have a big thing about local, having your food right production close to your cities.
Mm-hmm. So that's one thing about place too, right? Is some things, so when I have my students try to figure out how much we could feed our campus. So our campus, our farm has 22 acres of growing space, for example. So what if we used, if we got permission to use our whole farm on campus to try to feed our student body of 17,000 for how long could we feed ourselves off 22 acres? Right, and so we try to figure out, well, what would be a good thing to eat off of that? Let's use black beans, and we use black beans, and we talk about how black beans grow, and really we could feed our campus on black beans for about 3 days.
Oh,
off 22 acres, right? So yeah, not very long. We could have lettuce for a lot longer, but we'd be a lot hungrier in the meantime, right? Because lettuce doesn't fill you up the way black beans do, right? And so there are some things that it really helps to grow at scale. So grains and beans, it really helps to grow those at scale. And there's some great places in this country to do that. There's some great land for growing some of those products at scale. Because growing dry beans at a home scale is really hard. It's really hard to get large quantities that you would use to really feed yourself for a long time. But we should grow, it's like, we think about what would grow well where? Well, grains and beans, but then they're also lighter and when you transport them dry, so that reduces that cost of shipping. Whereas vegetables, how do vegetables usually arrive?
In a timely manner.
In a timely manner, and cold, right?
Yeah.
So there's, if when vegetables are harvested, they're cooled, often right there are, now the way that vegetables are harvested, they're harvested right and they're cleaned and put into cooling containers right in the field. I mean, the mobile units that move through fields now. And so they're cooled right away, and then they're kept cool all the way to the grocery store. That's a lot of energy used to keep those vegetables cold. So vegetables on a local scale, that makes a lot of sense, and fruit on a local scale, it makes a lot of sense to really, if we honed in on that a lot more. And then grain and bean production on a large scale, that makes more sense that way too. So thinking about what is appropriate for what place, right? Oh, another thing with politics and economy, just people in general with the climate. So we have people working in fields. So not only are animals heat stressed, but farm workers experience heat stress too. And what are my numbers? There are farm workers in California that die every year in 90 or 100 degree heat, but they're not usually counted as heat-related fatalities by the Occupational Safety and Health. Right, but there was a group that went back through, and a newspaper actually looked back through through data and found there really probably of 209 farm worker illnesses, probably that 97 were heat related in a period of time. So as we think about warming climate and farm workers out there, they'll be experiencing that heat stress too.
Increase of pesticides or herbicides impact people who work there.
That's true, very much so. And not just the people that work there, but the schools nearby. And in where I live in California, in Santa Cruz County produces much of the strawberries for the nation. Most of our nation's strawberries come from our county. And the agriculture is tight in with homes and schools. It's all very close in. Anytime land goes up for sale, there more houses come in, but that means everything is bumping right up against each other. So, and definitely strawberries, if they're not organic, they use quite a bit of pesticides in different ways.
The herbicides and pesticides, at least in the Midwest, where fields are gigantic compared to what you're talking about.
Yeah, here, definitely.
Have totally changed things. They're destroying all the microorganisms in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that isn't even being talked about long term is the effect on the soil and what's going to happen. And a lot of that soil is being used for corn, for alcohol.
Yes.
Because there's a market for it, which isn't really a market. They're being subsidized so much.
Right.
And then we're not getting that kind of food because that's what the land is used for. And so it's very short term, both in vision but also in terms of the economy. And so it's the market again, it's just driving that. It's what killed the family farm in the Midwest. I grew up with that, and
yeah.
I understand it. So it's, and it will continue to have an effect.
Okay. So maybe that's around economy and people and politics. I mean, the market is affected
yes.
by politics, it's affected by people, definitely, in America. We want what we want it now.
Exactly, and we want as much as we want.
Yeah, it's really interesting that trends is here. I don't know if I missed it because I have to put children to bed at nighttime, right? Because that's better than not putting children to bed at nighttime. And so trends, like when we as Americans have shifts in our diet, it has really profound effects. One was that like our great interest, sudden interest in quinoa. People eat quinoa. We kind of did that all at once, and it put a lot of pressure on, I think the quinoa, a lot of it was coming from Ecuador. I could be slightly off, is that right? Ecuador? And then people in Ecuador were not able to buy quinoa because it was so much cheaper, or I mean, they get, not cheaper, they got so much more money by selling it to the United States, the local. Well, the distributors, probably not the growers themselves, but the distributors got the money to sell it to the U.S. And so we had a really profound effect on another place really rapidly because we get very excited about things. Not that, I love quinoa. Quinoa is a really great food, but we have to figure out like, okay, so we like quinoa now, so how do we grow quinoa in the Midwest? It turns out quinoa can grow great in Colorado. Colorado's a perfect place for quinoa. So how do we shift agro ecosystems without these really major effects. Yeah.
Well, part of it too is like consumer tastes and international markets sort of just created some crazy things in terms of, we do a lot of almonds in California.
Yeah.
A lot of it goes internationally and it's really sort of expensive water-wise to make and all kinds of ways to make. So.
Yeah. Almonds have a really bad rap in California right now. They're very much
But so part of it is because it's not, you know, it's a very, very profitable thing to produce in international markets as well as in international markets.
Yeah. And they're, yeah, they get...
The fact that it's drawing down the aquifers, yeah.
Yeah, well, the fact that it's, like, it's getting the water that's, yeah, coming down from the mountains.
Well, and also, it is a crop that you have to irrigate year after year, whereas if you do vegetables and things like that, if you're in a drought, you can't plant those, whereas almond trees, you have to keep watering. So it's, you lose that flexibility about how you use your water.
So I'll report back to you in like 2 years. There's a grad student in our department who's looking at, apparently almonds are grown dry farm in Spain. On a large scale, but dry farm almonds.
Is that literally what it sounds like? They don't irrigate them?
Yeah, dry farm. So dry farm, I'll be interested to hear what she finds out because, right, you get the plants started. You give them enough irrigation, you get them started. And then you stress them so they have to send their own roots out. I guess it's kind of like parenting philosophies too, right? Like, so how much do you just let them have and how much do you make them kind of go for themselves?
Yeah.
And then...
So tap roots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they access more water. If you give a tree a lot of, or other plants a lot of water, they'll keep their roots closer to the surface and try to keep feeding that way. And then this forces them to go deep.
Comment the question.
Yeah.
I wish I'd thought of a graduate thesis that would send me to Spain.
I know. I'm have to like sample almonds in California.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of awful.
Do you have any feel for what the effect of developing monocultures through these GMOs has been?
Yeah. So my the way I kind of see GMOs is, the problem is it takes a lot of research and time and effort to develop any one GMO line, right? So it's a lot of hard work, and people have to do that and to get them to be able, yeah, for every line. And what I worry about is putting, like, it's reducing the diversity in our food system. So that's what I'm not... There have been some concerns. There are kind of other concerns around them, but my biggest one is just that we're losing that diversity. If we only have a few varieties of corn that we're really growing on a large scale, we've had like the Irish potato famine happened because the Irish potato crop was all genetically the same, and then it was susceptible to this virus, and then people were hungry because it was all the same.
Yeah, microorganisms apparently adjust pretty quickly to what's out there to eat.
Yeah.
Then they get overwhelmed.
Yeah. So if it's all the same, that's kind of the big deal to me. And to me, what it feels like with climate and agriculture is that we don't know, like I was saying, we don't really know what the effects on pollinators are going to be. We're guessing about the effects on pests, but there's a lot of different pests. There are a lot of different weeds. There are a lot of different insects that like to eat plants. There are a lot of different viruses and fungal pathogens. I mean, you got to think farmers are out there fighting all of these all the time, right? And if there are a lot of these we don't know about, we don't know exactly what's going to go on in the soil as those communities. Soil has this... all these communities right there in the soil, right? We don't know what the effect on all the organisms is going to be. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with our animals. And it seems like the more diversity we have, the more different kinds of apples we have, the more different kinds of peas we have, the more different kinds of everything, the more likely a few of those are going to be okay, right? And if we decrease that diversity, if we've lost that diversity, I just worry that we're like so much more susceptible.
Does that happen with bananas?
Yeah, bananas. Right now, the main kind of banana that all of us eat is the Chandler banana, the Chandler variety. And it is currently under major attack by a pathogen. And there's questions about how long we're going to have bananas. Because they're...
Didn't bananas go through something like this quite a few years ago?
Yeah, I think there was previously. That there have been other times, too. And because they are genetically the same, it's the same plant material. It's made through divisions, not through through pollination with other bananas, but literally the same material. Yeah.
Isn't industrial agriculture kind of taking us in the opposite direction of diversity,
yeah.
Biodiversity?
Yeah, right. So industrial large-scale agriculture is very much about the same varieties and the same scenarios placed wherever, right?
It's about yield and money.
Yeah.
And cheap food.
Yeah. And of course, organic farmers need to be about yield and money too, right? Because that's their job. And we don't they don't have the benefit of other subsidies. They'll, like, depending on where you are, you'll have water subsidies as a farmer, but you don't have the some of the larger subsidies.
You know, agriculture's quest for high production, looking at wheat is a good example of how they've, not through GMO, but just through selective planting, they've got wheat now that it's taller, has high production, but the food value is significantly below what do you get with smaller varieties of wheat.
Right, right. There might be out there, but is anybody a big fan of Red Delicious apples?
Yeah.
Oh, right, well, there are a couple. Okay, good, okay. But a lot of the Red Delicious, in Iowa, there's the early Red Delicious trees. And so you can still get early Red Delicious apples before they've been further selectively bred. The ones that are bred now are really bred to have five nice points on the bottom, so they stand well like this in displays. And they're meant to store really well for a long time, so they'll store well in cold storage, right, and be, like, perfectly red. The ones in Iowa are not as perfectly shaped, and they have better, I think they have better flavor than the current Red Delicious, right, because that's what they just haven't been bred and bred and bred for this one purpose, which is, like, display.
Right.
How were these bred with genetic modification?
Just over time. Just over time.
Selective breeding.
Yep. Yeah. So it's interesting just to think about, right, how what we're choosing along the way. So there's all these different aspects of how climate and agriculture, they're super intertwined, and everything we do in agriculture is every time. In this highly industrialized food system, we're releasing a lot of carbon dioxide because it's heavily fossil fuel dependent, the way we get our food to us now, right? And so that's having an impact on the climate, and the climate is what the agriculture depends on. They're just so intertwined. Let me make sure that there were... another thing that's changing with place is that not only are the pests going to be moving, but because... the plants need certain chill hours. Another thing some of them need is particular pollination windows, which pollination temps really is what I mean. Like tomatoes, when they're above, I'm forgetting what the number is now, so like 78 degrees, they won't set pollen the same way. The pollen won't be viable. And so if it's too hot, or maybe it's 90, I don't remember, but they're... Tomatoes, if it's too cold, they won't have viable pollen. If it's too hot, they also won't have viable pollen. So you have this window in the middle that the tomatoes need. And wine grapes don't like it. They like hot, but not too hot, right? They like some moderated temperatures. All kinds of crops, they have this window. And chocolate, by the way, chocolate also has a very particular window. And it's a very warm window because we can't grow chocolate here, right? Chocolate needs a very
not yet.
No. But chocolate has this has very particular conditions. And so what we're seeing is that crops either need to move, they're going to move north, or they're going to need to move upslope because mountains are cooler on top than lower.
Or indoors, like tomatoes
indoors.
Going indoors. So many tomatoes now are in.
Because they can control those conditions and have optimal pollination all the time.
Yeah.
So just thinking about that, where the literally things will move up one way or another. Somebody was looking at changes in Canada's recommended in their USDA growing regions, and they found that probably right now you can grow hardy citrus on Vancouver Island. And that they're expecting hardy apple, pear, and plums around Yellowknife, Canada, in the Northwest Territories. So things will be, that it's just shifting up. Another problem is with temperature is hastening ripening. And so speaking of apples again, there's an article that's fairly depressing that says that we no longer have good apples, essentially is what it says, because if things ripened really swiftly, they're going to be putting all those sugars and growing the apples, but then they're not developing as much of the acids and the complexity of the flavor if they're growing bigger, quicker, and ripening more swiftly. So this article said if you're under 40, you've never had a good apple, which is fairly sad to give my students. But and I may be a little extreme, but that's what's happening too. Okay. Oh, and then one other way climate and agriculture are interlinked is that we're expecting more extreme weather events. So farmers losing more to more drought or more flooding. Things like hail, right? That they were expecting the changes like that, too. Right.
You know, as the temperature goes up, the warmer the air, the more moisture it holds.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some of these weather events have to do with the fact that because there's now more moisture being held in the atmosphere, that when it does release and you drop below the dew point and the rains come down, it comes down a lot harder and there's a lot more of it.
Yeah.
So we're getting
right.
more flooding. And the problem, one of the big problems is that the aquifers are being drained.
Mm-hmm.
The aquifers don't restore in a season just because it's raining. That surface runoff, some of it trickles down. Like when we get snow in the mountains, a lot of it trickles down through the mountains back into the aquifer. But the bigger issue is that those aquifers are running out, and those wells, especially in the Midwest, that are down, let's say they're down 100 feet, you have to drill deeper to get to the aquifer. So the aquifers are being drained down. And one of the words you mentioned earlier was more. We need more food, we need more variety, we need more. And yet we've got limited resources.
Yeah.
So these finite resources are being drained down.
Right.
And that's the big question now is, okay, yeah, they had record snowfall and rainfall. California's reservoirs are full.
Yeah.
The aquifers aren't recharged.
No, not in a season like that.
And I've been doing some work down in the San Joaquin Valley in Stockton. Talking to some of the farmers and the growers down there, and they're concerned, especially for this summer, that there's lots of surface water, but it's not going where they need it. It's not going into the wells. Their irrigation, their irrigation issues already.
Yeah.
Well, and so the substructures are being compressed.
Right.
And
exactly.
So we're going to end up with aquifers that even if we had good years of rain, it won't store as much water as they used to store. Right. And you can see these pictures of people standing with a measuring rod in the Central Valley and talking about where the land level used to be and where it is now, and it used to be like much higher than it is now. You know, so really just
the aquifer is like a sponge or like an ink cartridge where I can inject more ink into it and fill it back up, but it doesn't fill up instantly. It doesn't fill up in one season.
Yeah, it doesn't fill up, and you also might have squashed the top of it while you were pulling it out of the printer.
Dried out the sponge. You know, a damp sponge will absorb moisture much quicker. A dry sponge does not.
Yeah.
So these aquifers, I think in the Midwest, the aquifers are having some big problems. In Florida, I was reading about this, that they were having issues with, what they did was they had four wells coming down like this. They would drill an injection well further down and inject treated wastewater down below to push the aquifer up, to push that water up to those tapping wells.
Yeah.
And what they were finding were increased levels of chemicals in drinking water. Because they were finding increased levels of Lipitor and Crestor and heart medications that were showing up in the children who were drinking the water out of the water fountains at school. And the problem
yeah.
was that they were treating the wastewater for biologics, but they couldn't treat it for the chemicals.
Yeah.
So injecting this down into the aquifer, now you have contaminated the aquifer with these subsequent chemicals that are now in the drinking water supply. And how do you get rid of that?
Yeah.
They'll be underwater. Well, Florida will be underwater pretty soon anyway.
Maybe we'll be in Antarctica.
There's not.
The sharks would be getting Lipitor.
Sharks love Lipitor, yeah. Yeah, and...
Heart healthy sharks.
And then we eat the heart healthy sharks.
Circle of
water.
So there are lots of ways that it's connected, right? So then we can start to think about, well, how do we change this system? And this is another place where I don't have all the answers yet, right? Because this web is really, and we're not even getting all the connections on here. It was really tightly bound all around, that all these things are connected one to another. And like we were saying earlier, this isn't just a Washington situation or a West Coast situation or a U.S. situation, but we're connected globally, all these issues. Like right now, the Chinese are buying up land in the kind of southeastern U.S., and they're also, there's a lot of rainforest coming down right now, because the Chinese are buying land for corn production in the U.S. And there's also Amazon forest being cut down right now for soybeans that are also bound for China, because China has pork is a really important food to them, and especially as part of having status in a society. And as more people have resources, the pork consumption is going up. And so there's this crazy connection, right? That Amazon forest is being cut. We worked on it for figuring out how to not have as much rainforest cut down for cattle for the U.S. So that was a bigger concern in like the 90s. But that's not as huge a concern right now. But then now is this soybeans going to feed pork in China. So it's like this huge. But what do? We just say, oh, sorry, China, you can't eat meat, but you can't eat pork, but we'll eat what we want to, right? So it's this huge connected web. And with economies and people and politics and markets and trends, and that's all connected in there too. But there are a few things that I think, a few directions we can go. So just to have me stop talking for a minute too. So just in your group, what do you think? Like, what are ways that we could start approaching this? What do you know about? What do we think? So what are a few of the ways that we can do this? Or do you want me? I can just start telling you what I have, and you can. Yeah. Want to hear it?
Yeah. Sure.
So one is potential solutions. One is reduced meat in the diet.
Plant-based.
Yeah, plant-based diet. So still having meat and still that can be part of the food system. And actually, in some places, animals can eat things that humans can't, or in places that we can't we can't farm well. There's even an example of that down by Santa Cruz. There's Left Coast Beef, which I think is a hilarious name for a beef operation at the Tomcat Ranch. And they have cattle grazing on these hillsides down by Santa Cruz on the grasslands where they totally couldn't farm. There's no water up on those hillsides to farm, but they rotationally graze the cattle around, and so they really need to provide very little water for them over the year. They just really manage the land well. It does take. I have my students think about the economics of this though. It means low stocking rates because they have to do this well. They can't put as many animals out there as if they had as if they were doing it otherwise. And they also, let's see, low stocking rates. The meat costs more per pound for sure. And so it would be food for a relatively small area, but but making good use of these hillsides. And actually, the way they're doing it is restoring the hillsides from previous bad management. So they're restoring native species on those lands, and it's increasing the soil carbon. So when you have particular annual grasses, if you have grasses that just come up each year and die, their root systems are not very big. Right? Does that make sense? You just come up, you die, you're not going to be investing a lot. But if you are a perennial plant and you're growing year after year, even when your top dies, every year your underground biomass is growing and growing and growing. You have so many roots. And so these store a lot more carbon back down in the soil. So well-managed grazing even has a potential for helping to draw back down some of that carbon. And then maybe if that land had just been left under old annual system, but it's like going to help regenerate that land more rapidly. But that meat we'd be eating less of it than the way we have it in stockyards right now. It's a general, yeah.
We're just talking about sort of advances that are going on now in terms of the variety of different kinds of legumes that are available, and they call Rancho Gordo up in Napa that produces these incredible variety of beans that are just, they beat a hamburger any day. So, I mean, a lot of them do.
Yeah, they're really good. Yeah, I've had some of those too, and they have a great label.
Yeah, right. And calendars. They have really great calendars.
Oh, they do? I'm going to have to find a Rancho Gordo calendar.
Rancho Gordo?
Rancho
like
Gordo.
Like Fat Ranch.
And you pay a flat rate for postage, so you...
And they're dry, right? So they're not in a can, so they're dry.
Fun.
So they're not very heavy.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah.
These guys were talking about technology improvements, like perhaps smart meters, electrical meters, or... or incentivizing or making knowledge about this stuff entertaining.
The goal of which is the gamified thing is kind of fun to talk about.
So it's beyond that.
So starting out, it would be just raise awareness of what is your footprint, right, on your electrical bill, airplane tickets, bus tickets, anywhere you're getting transported. Your car itself could tell you pretty easily, right?
Yeah,
on your credit card annual report.
Then make it a game with financial rewards.
Yeah.
I'll just give you
we're going to start a company.
Actually, I already work in this world. I could build the app.
There we go. All right.
Do a startup.
We can't start it tonight because of the no Wi-Fi thing
we'll
up here.
We'll do the holding GoFundMe account today.
That's right. We'll set that up. Yeah. And technology in the field too. They're finding that we can have more technology for farmers to use to better manage irrigation, to better manage. Maybe one day we'll be able to come up with
the soil.
Yeah.
You know, I think with 5 years of drought in California, farmers have already gone to more efficient irrigation system using technology.
Yeah.
So even, hopefully, if that will have to continue.
Yeah.
Because water is not going to be available.
And because, this water is really heavy. Moving water around the state, if you've ever, so a lot of water moves, efficient irrigation. A lot of water moves very passively down California, down this long aqueduct, but it takes effort to pump it up to that little height to begin with before it can begin its long, passive journey hundreds of miles down the state. And then for it to get over other humps, like the last hump to get up into LA, if you've ever driven down 5 into LA, there's a last giant hill you gotta go over. The energy to get the water up that last hill is really remarkable, and I imagine does Imperial Valley connect just right into the base of the Central Valley, or is there a mountain range?
Most of that water comes from the Colorado.
Oh, right, it's coming from Colorado. Yeah, because so we can deplete other states and Mexico. Yeah, but this efficient irrigation, it takes ever, even for, if you have a private well, that the electricity cost to pull the water out of the ground is... it's pretty high. And so that's all, if you're needing to pump it, that's using energy, and so releasing carbon.
Plus evaporation as it goes down a long 5. Yeah.
Yeah, evaporation over a long way. No, it's a pretty amazing system. Yeah. And then, so these are connected to technology in the field for irrigation and other purposes. We might be able to do that more. Incorporating more legume fertilizer. I think that was coming up. Did I hear that over here at one point?
Yeah. What's that mean?
So the way that we get, synthetic fertilizer is this really amazing process, the Haber-Bosch process, and it was, what happens is you're splitting nitrogen apart. So nitrogen gas that we breathe in and out all the time is N2, like this, and it's two nitrogen molecules. I think it's a triple bond. Is that right? I think it's a triple bond between these two nitrogens. It's a very, very strong bond. And so to break that apart and put it into a form that plants can use, you have to use, it happens when there are lightning strikes. Lightning will split some nitrogens apart. And so you're essentially doing the same thing in a factory. You're using a lot of energy to split nitrogen and get it to bind on onto hydrogen atoms, for example. And so that Haber-Bosch process is really energy intensive. But the kind of amazing thing is that these legumes do it themselves. They do it in the ground. Yeah. And so they're down here with these little nodules on the roots. And this, I think it's just the most amazing thing. So these little nodules, along comes a bacterium in the soil, and it knocks on the door of the root and pokes like a little infection thread in, and then the plant responds by making a little home for the bacteria to live in, and the bacteria fix nitrogen in that nodule, and then they send it up into the plant as amino acids, and the plant feeds them carbohydrates. So they get to stay and hang out there. And so they do this splitting work. They're taking nitrogen coming down in the soil and just in the air pockets in the soil. It's coming in and they're turning it into these organic forms that are then in the plant. So if you plant these legumes, and then as long as you don't harvest all the beans off of them, then you not because if you let them go to seed and you take the beans, when the beans are high in protein, right? And protein is based on nitrogen, it has a lot of nitrogen in it. So as long as you're not harvesting all your beans, because if you harvest all your beans, then you just harvested all the nitrogen that they fixed. But as long as you're not doing that and you knock it in earlier, then they're really feeding this nitrogen into the soil.
So how many work would be like a double crop or a...
Or you use it, yeah, you could do double crop or you could do cover crops. They're called cover crops, but the main goal is just to put them in for the nitrogen.
And then you'd like to do that every other year? Or,
you do it in the, California, you can do it in the winter, which has other benefits too. You're shielding the soil from the effects of the rain and all kinds of things. Yeah. So more, figuring out how to incorporate that more. I just read a book... Lentil Uprising, I think is what it's called. Lentil Underground. The Lentil Underground. About farmers in Montana that started doing, they started incorporating more and more lentils into their rotation. But then how hard it was, it's the marketing part, right? How hard it was to figure out how to sell the lentils in kind of like a easy kind of way, that it wasn't just like taking up their whole world trying to figure out how to get these lentils off their hands once they had them. But they saw the lentils really nourishing the soil. And so this one thing is that you're feeding the soil nitrogen, but you're also feeding it all the carbon from the plants. And so as we've been talking about, all you're doing is just putting in the fertilizer, then the soil microbes that live down here, they don't eat fertilizer. They eat bits of roots, and they eat the shoots, and they eat all the carbon that's coming, the other carbon that's coming in from the plant. And so the more that you can feed them kind of over a long time, the more healthy that soil is going to be. It's really cool to see how that you can do it. there's a farm on our campus. There's also this one garden that's up on a hillside. It's called the Chadwick Garden. It was founded by this eccentric Shakespearean actor who happened to love the idea of small-scale gardening. And actually, he not only the idea, but he loved to do it. And so he when they said, where do you, well, okay, so you can put a garden on campus. Where do you want to put it? He said, give me, like, he scouted for the worst piece of property on the UCSC campus. And so he found this one where it already, but the topsoil had been scraped off. It was really clayey with poison oak and all this awful stuff. And now, after 40 years, you can sink your arm almost 3 feet in the beds. They're just unbelievable.
How big of a plot?
How big is the Chadwick Garden? Maybe like 5 acres, maybe less than that, maybe 2 acres. And it has fruit trees interspersed. It's such a hard thing to describe. Because it's like the book The Secret Garden, opening the door into a secret garden. You go through the redwoods and into this space that has fruit trees and beds on the hillsides. It's amazing. But they totally transformed it over time. Yeah.
One of the things that movie last night, Demain, talked about in terms of food production was they talked about gardening in these specific ways. And there were several ideas put forward, but one of them was this high intense. I mean, you're not doing rows like this. Everything is just jammed in the beds. And then you're layering also that certain canopy things work well, and then there's something that works well under that, and then on the floor there's something else that... It was really cool. It was very data-based, you know, farming. But it was also kind of chaotic. Like, you know, they said, okay, come in here. And they were prying apart things to try to... It's made for human harvesting. Yeah. Not...
Right.
Has anybody been to Eastern Washington lately and seen how all of the orchards are going to computer, you know, robotic picking? They're taking all the trees and they're splaying them like this. And they're almost like whatever that's called.
Espalier.
Yeah, espalier. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're doing all the new acreage is going in that way. So that they can just run the machine down there and pick it.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how that affects the quality of the apple, too.
Yeah.
And also, along with the apple orchards, especially the Chelan-Manson area here, they're all apple orchards and now they're going to vineyards.
Yeah,
I know. So that's why I think, right? Is it with climate change, we might not have anything to eat, but we're gonna have a lot of wine.
But it's also that's an economic issue. The farmers are making more money making wine and selling grapes than they are selling apples.
Or the land is going for more.
Well, and also there's less maintenance. They don't have to do as much. You know, they don't have the tree issues. It's just vines and. They grow quickly and they're making fast fortunes. Mental Valley, especially.
There's a lot of competition, though. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that land goes for a lot. When somebody comes in has big bucks and they want to put in a winery, it goes for a lot more than it does as an apple orchard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then figuring out how to reduce tillage. So we've got to work this out. And it's going to look different in different places. It can be one way, this grower in Pennsylvania who is just a firebrand, right, for this system. He's got it working. I swear that his organic matter, he has so much organic matter going into this system, and he has all these creative things he's doing, like he's using, he calls them biodrill radishes. So he plants these big forage radishes that you would feed to animals. They're not like radishes we would eat, but he plants them and they go down and they're like helping aerate the soil, the radishes themselves. And he is just a kick. And so he's got this system. And I was there on like a July day one year. And I swear you could just feel the place was alive. And he says that at night you can hear the earthworms eating in his fields because there's so many of them. Because he's not doing tillage. So adding that, I said, that carbon dioxide plume, right? But he's not disrupting the earthworm populations and all these other populations, springtails, all these little organisms in the soil. He's not disrupting them over and over.
What is his main crop?
What is his main crop? What is his main crop? I think he grows a lot of corn.
Okay.
Pumpkins, I think, are in his. I'm trying to think of what else I totally remember corn. I'd have to look.
Okay, so he does all this and it ups his corn production?
Yeah. It's all totally beneficial for what?
What's his name?
Let's see. I'll work on it. Okay. I'll come up with it. I'll think of it.
Okay.
Not yet, though, apparently. But somehow I'll think of it.
I totally relate.
It's not bugging you at all.
No. And it says, soil is meant to be tilled. That's what his slogan is.
Oh, well, I think Google that.
Yeah, soil is meant to be, not soil is meant to be tilled, soil is meant to be covered. Sorry, it's not soil is meant to be tilled. Soil is meant to be covered. Oh my gosh. It's warm, it's afternoon, I'm losing my head right. So, and there's another farmer I saw in Minnesota that is doing the strip tillage, and he also has such gorgeous land. He showed too, and this is like how, it's again how everything is so interconnected, right? So Tony Thompson on his farm in Minnesota, he showed pictures, because so when he's doing strip tillage, so he's got his field, and he's only driving down the same lanes every time. He's only driving the same spots in his field every time. So his impact from tractors is really low, which is also improving his soil health. And he showed pictures of his farm after a huge rain, after he'd been doing this for several years, and an adjacent farm after a huge rain. And the other farm, you could see all the tire tracks everywhere, and there was water pooling here and there and everywhere. And on his farm, the water just sinks right into the soil. So he's building such beautiful soil. Yeah.
Don't forget, one of the factors in that is technology, because the computerized tractor, you can literally do that. You can GPS, you can go over the same exact spot, and they're avoiding these corner ponds through technology, which is, they just sit back and listen to NPR all day.
Right, NPR, right? Where's Jason? They're listening to NPR, definitely.
All day long.
Well, if you computerize everything and you don't need the people to do the work, then the people don't have jobs to buy the food that you're producing on sites.
Right.
This is a huge, it's very complicated. The technology sounds great, but I work with a lot of technology and people that are very nervous about losing their jobs. It's almost like the president says, hey, we're going to redo coal mine. We're going to get coal people back to work, but the coal people aren't there.
Now, that's a whole other topic.
With the technology, I work with building systems and irrigation. I mean, I do a lot of stuff, and the technology is great, and it cuts corners, but it also cuts jobs. People that would normally be driving those tractors aren't driving those tractors anymore.
Well, my uncle farmed 500 acres, and my cousin farms 1,500 acres, one kid.
Yeah.
So, but my cousin couldn't survive on 500 acres. You can't make enough on 500 acres. So he had to.
Yep.
He had to expand, and he does it by himself with the help from his retired dad. And you know.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, that isn't a whole lot. That's not like it put a whole lot of people out of work.
No, it's not that. It's how the economics work. You know, and I've always been a proponent of follow the money. Who's benefiting from this financially? You know, Monsanto has a lot of money wrapped up in this. I've done work with the USDA and their plant genome expression stuff. You know, I'm doing energy work, but I'm working in their centers. And some of the things they're coming up with and the new plants and, you know, not using pesticides, but, you know, modifying the plants so that plants aren't attracted to them. Then you start to affect the insect populations and the bees are affected. And, oh my God, it's just...
It goes so well when man gets involved in nature, doesn't it? Usually.
It goes great. Yeah. Totally.
What are the crowns up? Or strip tillage? Or minimum till?
What they're really doing with like strip till and other forms of dish till are big grains like corn and they'll have soy in that rotation. Corn gets so much attention, but there are probably lots of other things we could do this way too.
So one thing that comes to mind is you drive around these cities, you drive around the country, and you see these big golf courses, and you see these big lawns, and you think, oh, here's a bunch of grass that all we do is water it to make it green so we can enjoy how it looks.
Yep.
Or make sure that our 9-iron will reach the green or whatever. But if you take golf courses, they're already irrigated, and you turn them into farms. If you have school, I've been in school districts where sometimes the schools have these huge paved play fields. And instead of saying, hey, let's go outside and play kickball, why don't we go outside? Let's go outside and tend the garden and take some of these arable spaces. And there's thousands, maybe millions of acres of this around our country that are ready to be used, but we use them for something else. So maybe it's revitalizing our...
It's like redistributing agriculture.
Yeah.
So, like, oh, I forgot to ask you the other day about what you think about the distributed grid, right? But it's kind of that same thing. Like, what do we need to grow on the big scale? What do we need to, and then what can we do more of on small scale?
Well, the thing about that is that you've already got, most of these golf courses are in cities. Schools are in cities. So you're producing vegetables or whatever you're doing closer to the load, closer to the people who are going to consume it. So instead of trucking stuff from California to Washington, maybe we start growing more of that food in Washington, reduce the transportation costs, and have fresher food that's readily available. But teaching the children how to farm. This is how you make food. This is how it comes from. Because right now, everybody thinks it comes from Safeway.
Most of the schools in Seattle Public Schools have a garden on site, and they do garden education.
But it's small.
Well, yeah,
really,
but I mean, they're growing it, they're harvesting it, they're eating it. 2 weeks ago, they were sitting on back, you know, with their plates of salad.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's little...
It's
and then started. Remember during the recession how all of a sudden backyard gardens were really trendy? Remember
well,
that?
I think in Alameda, which is outside of San Francisco, it's the 10th city, maybe 75,000. But there is a whole backyard garden movement, and there's... the chicken, people are chickens
yes.
in their yard.
Yeah.
And all the schools have a garden where they grow food. But again, not enough to feed
yeah.
people. But also Alice Waters of Chapinese Restaurant began having Berkeley students grow the food for her restaurant.
It seems like kind of, I don't mean to be for water, it seems like kind of a privilege of the rich. Your backyard garden and chickens and that
well,
I enjoy myself.
Yeah.
I mean, we can afford to
yeah.
spend the time to tend our own little mini garden. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if it could be turned around where the stuff at Walmart isn't the cheapest, you know, it's so cheap that it's the only thing I could viably get with a very small paycheck or two.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And all this stuff is great. And unless it's an economic benefit, there's no way it's going to happen fast. I mean, we can come up with all these great ideas, but unless people are benefiting from it economically, like I could see that guy who's a corn farmer benefiting from planting the radishes because it economically benefits him because he turns out more crops.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to find a way to mesh the two, the great ideas, the ideas we know will work, it's out there,
mm-hmm.
with economics so it does work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tough part. That's the hardest part right there.
And our most important resource, which is the one we don't have enough of, is time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I've got to go to work 8 hours and do what I do, and then go home and tend my garden for 4 hours,
exactly.
You know, then I don't have that resource. And that's, and it's expensive. I've got to go buy the fertilizers, I've got to buy the tools. So there's this whole economic component in that work.
Yes.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, totally a challenge.
So, like,
oh, we can put the unemployed people to work, you know, the people who get put out of work by technology, we can put them to work on our golf course farms.
And then another really big one, so this is this really great, I really like this book by Paul Hawken, it's called Drawdown. And Paul Hawken took this whole team of people to work with him, and they looked at like 100 different potential solutions for getting carbon back out of the atmosphere and back into the soil. And it's everything from, let's see, what do we have? Like, use more bamboo or landfill methane or that one's insulation, clean cook stoves, solar farms, bullet trains, everything's in here. And so they looked and they ranked these all by, they looked at the total net, the total, how many gigatons of carbon dioxide you'd reduce using this strategy, and what the total net cost in dollars and the total net savings in dollars are too. So they looked at that for all of these and did their best, got their best estimates, and then wrote this all up. And the number three solution for reducing carbon dioxide is reducing food waste. Of all the things they looked at, because they were looking at what can we really get on the ground and running fastest, right? So reducing food waste is this huge, huge issue.
What is the biggest source of this food waste? We don't seem to have it in our house.
Well, okay, you because so
is it
you're an outlier.
Grocery store? What?
No. It's 35% is lost at by consumers in industrialized countries. So, like U.S., Canada, New Zealand, Australia, industrialized Asia, and Europe. On average, consumers chuck out 35%, and that's not counting like potato peelings or that's like we throw out 35% of our food.
But you're thinking people who cook.
That's like a third
but remember,
of every
most
edible
people,
sandwich.
Most people don't cook now, they eat out, and that's where, is that true? That they're throwing most of that food away?
It's not even at the restaurant. There's also loss at restaurant levels or loss in the grocery stores or loss at the farm level. There's loss at every level. The farm level's my least concern because it goes back into the soil and makes more organic matter, right? But all these other points in the food system.
It's leaking.
Yeah, and so we have a couple things. So one is that we think about all the energy that goes into getting the food here. So if you take, my little podcast I did this morning, because there's going to be these like Holden like mini talks, and so I did mine this morning. And this is what it was about. It was I went out to the dump, I was taking our garbage out, and there's always interesting stuff in our dumpster when I open the lid. And one day there's a 5-pound bag of organic carrots sitting there in the top.
Wow. Someone went to Costco.
The carrots went in the back of the fridge, uh-huh. Right? Because they were still snappable, but they had the little
starting
white root hairs. Yep. Mm-hmm. And they forgot, and they brought them, and they pitched them. And so if you think about everything that went into that, first seed had to be grown. And carrots, I'm pretty sure that they're biennial, and you have to grow, they plant them, and then you grow them for, in the second season, they'll flower and produce their seeds. So first, seeds had to be, the land had to be for carrot seeds somewhere, and you have to fertilize that soil, and then you have to come through and you use, carrots have the coolest weed management. You can flame torch their seed beds. It's really cool to watch, though. One farmer told me about how his tractor kind of exploded on him. So you have to be careful of that, too. But carrot seeds take like 21 days. They're like my younger daughter sleeps in every morning, right? She's just that sleepy in child where the other one's up by 6 every day, right? So carrots are my younger child. They just want to take their time. You put them in, and they're going to think about it and stretch and about 22 days later, they'll pop up. And so you can go along and flame their seed bed. The weeds are my older child. And so they'll come up first. And then you take this propane flamer and you flame them all down. And it knocks back those early weeds.
Carbon
right there, right? Carbon in the propane flamer, right? And so, but the seeds aren't hurt, and then they come up. And there's no weeds, and they just think that's how life is, but there they go. So that you've prepared the land, you've flamed it, you're growing your plants for 2 years, so you're going to have to take care of weeds in that intermediate time. You're going to have to harvest the seed and clean the seed so there's no bits of other plant matter or such in there, and then package that seed and distribute it. Then the seed's going to make it to the farm. The seed bed is going to be made at this next farm, and the land prepared and fertilized and flamed again, and water is going to be delivered. Oh, water in both cases, right? And then the carrots are going to grow, and somebody's got to come through and harvest them. And they've got to be about this long to make it in the bag, and not wiggly, but the perfectly straight, so we're pitching some of those carrots along the way. Or sometimes they're made into cubed carrots, right? So they'll show up in other forms sometimes. So, and then if they're that right size and they've made it all the way through this, then they're put in a plastic bag, and that plastic bag came from petroleum from somewhere, right? And the plastic bags go in a box, a cardboard box that comes from trees, right? And so we've got those in the box. And then those had to be kept cold all the way from harvest through to Costco and then to the home, and then they were taken out of the fridge and tossed. Right? So all that led up to... And so this massive inefficiency in our food system, the way it is, that we just have so much available to us that we forget. I forget stuff's in the back of the fridge, right? We just forget it's there, and or we don't like it or whatever, right? But we just, in industrialized nations, we throw away so much food at our level and all, and leading up to that, too.
So it may not be him and I at our in our houses, like maybe we're really good, but upstream, you can't really, I mean, you have to think about the waste all the way from seabed to fridge and beyond.
Yeah, and there's the carbon dioxide released all along the way, right? Mm-hmm. And then at any one of those points where waste is going into the landfill, what then happens then is we're back to the situation where you have organic matter in a landfill, there's no oxygen, so it breaks, the way it breaks down releases methane instead of carbon dioxide. And methane is 23 times stronger as a greenhouse gas than CO2 is.
Oh, so it's doubly important to put your food waste in the compost.
It's 20.
Or 23.
Yeah, whatever number that is.
At the lower levels in the landfill, it's anaerobic activity.
Mm-hmm.
There's no oxygen, so anaerobic bacteria produce two things, right? Hydrogen sulfide and methane.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there's a great...
Does Seattle have any kind of a green waste, like, here?
Yes.
Yeah, Seattle totally does.
And they
it gets picked up weekly.
Yeah, so does we in Allen.
We're putting bones and meat, napkins, everything in there.
Right,
it's,
yeah.
I don't know what the...
You can even put in pizza
boxes.
Pizza boxes.
And I think it goes through a great big huge...
digester.
Yeah, and then comes out as compost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So
something. I don't know where it goes after that, but it comes out.
Well, you can buy it in all the stores. You know, it's what's it called? Yeah, it's bagged. They sell it again to us.
Yeah. Right. They
Cedar
sell
Grove.
It.
Cedar Grove compost.
Yeah. Right. Right.
It's in every store.
You can buy it back.
So you can go buy back your.
You've already paid for it once.
That's right.
And you can have your own worm bin. Shortcut.
Yes.
Friends of ours have a worm bin,
Yeah. We had a worm bin for a long time, and now in Santa Cruz we have somebody who picks up compost on her bike, her compostable materials, and so off it goes on bike, and then we build up point. We actually don't have to pay for our compost. We have to pay $5 a week per bucket to have it go out, but then you build up points, and we build up a lot of points in our house.
So
then you get it, you can use your points to get the finished compost back.
She's already gamified.
Mm. That's awesome. Yeah. But so Ivy's figured out how to make money off of compost
in
Santa Cruz.
She didn't even need that.
Yeah, and so there I have hope, and I think there are ways, and in fact when they looked at these of the top 20 solutions, I think 7 of them are agricultural. It's 7 or maybe it's 13. There's just a lot of different things that we can do. Oh, I can even figure it out real quick. This is such a great book though. Yeah, they have like regenerative agriculture and silvopasture, mixing pastures with tree production, that we can do more of that, and plant-rich diet and reduce food waste. These are some of the most important things we could do. There's also interesting ones. This group over here was talking about reducing the number of people. And one of the ways we do that is education of girls turns out to be hugely important. And if we educated all girls throughout the world, now we'd reduce our population by, if we did that by 2050, we'd reduce our population by like 835 million on our planet, just because.
Get the gates on those right now.
Yeah, get the gates over there. And I really like this book, talks a lot, it really talks about what we've been talking about, and I really like how at the end, instead of a closing, he has an opening at the end, and saying, okay, we have to do this, we have to do this now, and we have to really consider jobs, how we're going to do jobs in relation to this, and that climate solutions depend on community collaboration and cooperation. We really are going to have to think about people in the food system with any of these solutions, right? And really think about the effects. And then Michael Pollan, he has short pieces by other people. And Michael Pollan in here also recognizes that this is a really tough situation. And he really advocates growing your own plants as part of this, even just a little bit, because it just helps you just get a little bit connected with the food system. So this is most of what I had to just tell you. One last thing, like beyond all of this is, like, we have to figure out how to do this politically. And
just a little detail.
Economically. So how do we support all of that too? How do we make this all possible? And but Michael Pollan advocates for one last thing to tell you is this quote from Mark Bittman, who was a food writer at the New York Times, and he just left his position there in 2015 to work on a startup to make it easier for people to eat more plants. That's all it says about that. I'm not sure what that's exactly going to look like. And he didn't want a conflict of interest with his food writing at the Times, so he resigned from the Times to take that on. He says, there's also increasing pressure from audiences to propose solutions, but the problems are so fundamental that I often felt I should be writing about abolishing the Senate as a first step toward reducing the hegemony of monoculture. So just really recognizing that this is really an important part of all this and figuring out how we do that. So I don't have all the answers.
That was in that movie last night, too.
Oh, was it?
Domain was about democracy. They have some really interesting ideas in that movie. Yeah, I would recommend it. Get it. And, you know, it's like 2 hours long, so.
Okay.
Could have had it maybe in an hour chunk. It would have been easier to watch, but it was very good.
Yeah. It sounds great. So what I was going to do, too, is follow Michael Pollan's advice, if you like. The reason all the assorted bottles are out here in newspaper is I can show you how to make a plant pot if you want to try to do this and take down the hill. These are, I was so excited to see these. These are Orca Heritage beans from Bob's Red Mill. And you can see they look like, they're also called Calypso, but Bob's Red Mill folks thought they looked like, well, the grower thought they looked like orcas, so was calling this variety Orca. And Bob had said, these beautiful, Bob himself, I mean, it's got his signature right there. These beautiful orca beans caught my eye while visiting our growers in Moses Lake. That's in Washington for non-Washingtonians. The farmer cracked open a freshly picked pot and revealed the astonishing black and white beans nestled inside. We cooked a pot that night for supper, and the next morning I bought his entire crop. I hope that you will delight in this providential union of seed, earth, water, and sun, etc. So if you want, I can show you how to make a pot, and you can put soil in it, and you can plant a bean or two. Not that you will necessarily get edible beans out of these this growing season, but it's like symbolic of thinking about this. So you can if you like, but no pressure.
The school I'm at is the Orcas. We're the Orcas.
So oh, you are?
We're definitely.
You gotta
get some
of those.
And
some orca beans.
Get those in our school garden.
Yeah, but thank you for coming in here.